Hello, I'm Paola, and welcome to Contemplative Revolution, a podcast by the WCCM, about what it means to live a contemplative, spiritual, and Christian life while still playing an active role in a modern world. Join us for conversations with fellow contemplatives in action from around the globe. In this podcast, Lawrence Freeman explores the theme of the tradition of meditation as part of a series of monthly talks, Wisdom Living and the Joy of Connection, which are running in 2021. Check WCCM.org to register. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
So, welcome to everybody. I hope that this session, which is actually called the tradition of meditation, not the cave. The cave is next month. We go into the cave next month. I hope that these sessions will bring us into a deeper sense of hope and faith in humanity, faith in ourselves, faith in the capacity of the world to renew itself. We all know we live in a very critical time. We're kind of going through a dark night of the soul for humanity. But a dark night can also lead to regeneration and to resurrection, to renewal. So I hope that our time together, the sharing, the connection with a community, with a tradition, and with our own deeper self, that all of this connection will give more meaning and more energy and hope to each of us. And we'll leave it in God's hands and see what it what good it produces. But I hope that Saint Benedict says, whenever you begin a good work, you must pray to God to make sure that it works and to bring it to completion. So I'd like to just ask us all to take a few moments of silence, so that we can each pray that this time together today and in the future will be a time of regeneration and of new hope and new joy in our journey together. Amen. Well, I'm speaking to you from my room in Bombo, which is the international center and home of the WCCM. I've been living here now for about 2 years. We moved in 2 years ago. It's a beautiful old building, which we have been renovating. It was founded as a monastery in 1119, so 900 years ago, and we moved in 2019. So it was a monastery with a contemplative life being lived here for about 700 years till the French Revolution. And when we came here, we felt from the very first time we saw the place that this was calling us. It was a place where we could build a small community with a big heart, a big sense of hospitality, and that we could do a work for the world from here, to share the peace and the power of meditation to heal and to unite a broken and divided world. And in this past year, since COVID has kept us all at home, we have developed an online program which has really astonished us by how many people have taken part in it and how helpful it has been to them. And it's certainly been for me a way of discovering that the internet is a sign of great hope. The internet can get you addicted. It can waste a lot of time, and you can get very frustrated with your cell phone and your laptop. But we discovered really the spiritual power of the internet through this last year. And at one point during the past year, three of the community here were tested positive with COVID. So we all had to go into a deeper isolation, stay in our rooms. We meditated together online four times a day. And we would go down very carefully down to the dining room and take our meals separately and bring them back upstairs. But one of the, and actually it turned out to be in many ways a good experience. 3 weeks or two to three weeks was long enough. I don't think anyone wanted it to be longer than that. But we did experience a strong sense of connection with each other through meditating together, but also by doing some other things together. Every day we have a session where we reflect together on the rule of Saint Benedict. And during that period, somebody suggested that I gave some talks, a series of talks on the tradition of meditation. And I did that. And it was enjoyable for me to put it together, because I don't usually use PowerPoint when I talk, when I teach, but on this occasion I did. And it was quite fun putting it together. So I'm using that basic model for this series, and I've been using slides, which I hope you will find interesting. So this year is 2021 is the 30th anniversary of the founding of the WCCM in 1991 at New Harmony, Indiana, at the John Main Seminar. And it is often quoted, 1991, as the year when the World Wide Web started. So I think there is a kind of connection in some kind of design in sharing the 30th anniversary of the WCCM with the internet. And we've been able to discover the spiritual potential of the internet during this pandemic more than we ever did before. And I hope that this series of talks and meetings that we'll be having will be for you also, as I said, a time of renewal, of connection, of sharing the journey with each other. So now I'm going to share my screen, and here we go. Oh, one second. I haven't got my title up here. Where's my title? Can you see the screen? Yes. Oh, yeah. So I've always been very fascinated by caves, and next month, as I said, the theme will be caves. And a few break, I went down to a prehistoric cave, 40,000 years old, where our human ancestors gathered. And where some of them, the first artists known to humanity, created those most beautiful illustration drawings, paintings on the walls of Lascaux and Chauvet, these great caves in this part of France, actually not too far from Bombay. So this is a one of the scenes. It looks like something you've done yesterday. But it's one of the walls of one of the prehistoric caves, 40,000 years ago. And what does it mean? What do you think it means? Imagine you were exploring this cave. I think it was discovered about 1950, I think, or 1940, actually. And imagine you were, it was some kids playing football, and they kicked the ball down a hole in the ground, and they went after it, and they discovered this cave. What do you think they would have thought? Our ancestors put their hands, each of these hands is different. They left their mark. Human beings like to leave marks. We write graffiti, we carve our initials in places where we shouldn't do it. And they've left us this wonderful enigmatic sign of welcome, waving to us across the millennia. And I think it reminds us that we belong to a tradition. And meditation is part of this discovery. And I'd like you to think about these questions as we go into this exploration today of the tradition, the very roots, the oldest roots of the tradition of meditation in the human family. Who am I? It's even our ancestors, 40,000 years ago, Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. Now we know that they lived together and that they bred together. The Neanderthals were quite creative and imaginative people, as well as the sapiens. But it's part of what makes us wise that we can ask this question, who am I? And as soon as we ask that question, we face a fear. Am I the only one asking this question? Am I alone? And if I'm alone, where do I come from? How did I get here? And where am I going? What's going to happen to me in the future? Next year, or at the moment of my death? And so we come to these are very human questions. And this last question here is, do I belong? Do I belong in this world? And if I do, what's my meaning? What's my work? So, as soon as we begin to awaken, as soon as human consciousness began to awaken to itself, human beings realized that there is this mysterious paradox in the human, which is that we are myself, individuals. And with that can come a feeling of being alone, which is certainly for primitive people very frightening. They needed to be with the tribe, with the others, for safety, protection against wild beasts and other humans running around. So to be alone is instinctively frightening. But what is the reason for us being with others? Is it just to protect ourselves, to amuse ourselves? What is the connection between myself and others who are also asking the same questions that I am. And you can also say, myself. So here we have a picture of probably what these primitive ancestors, we call them primitive. They were great artists, some of them, and great inventors. And the technology they needed to create the paint, to paint those pictures on the walls of the caves that have lasted 40,000 years, was an amazing technology. And the brushes and the things that they used to paint them with were highly skilled pieces of technology. Anyway, on the right-hand side, we have a group of our ancestors sitting in a cave, talking about the hunt for the day, or talking about the children, talking about maybe what the artists have been painting on the walls. And on the left here is a group of children in our community in Indonesia who've been taught to meditate. And one of our priorities in the community is to bring meditation to children. We think probably the best way to change the world is to allow young children to discover as early as possible in their life what meditation means, and they have a capacity not just to think these questions, but to live them interiorly, to get out of the head and into the heart. And children have an amazing capacity to meditate, to love meditation. They love meditating. They don't say, oh, I don't have time, or, you know, I'm not good at it, or it's too much stress for me to meditate. They will meditate on their own as well as in the classroom. When they go home in the evening, parents often will say they meditate. And I asked one little girl once, she told me she meditates at home sometimes. And I said, when do you meditate at home? And she said, she thought for a moment, and then she said, whenever I have a fight with my sister. I think she understood experientially why meditation was important to her. John Mayne was an Irish Benedictine monk who was taught me to meditate when I was in my first year at university. And he's one of the great Christian spiritual teachers of our time, who's, because of his achievement in communicating the tradition of meditation in Christian faith, in Christian spirituality, not just to monks and nuns, but to everybody, and realizing, as he did, that meditation has an extraordinary capacity to create community, deep community, not just a tribe. It's easy enough to create a sense of unity among a group of football supporters of the same club, or people from the same nation, speaking the same language. But what is really challenging and necessary for our time, of course, is to understand that we are in communion, we have community with people of all faiths, all nationalities, all races, all creeds. And so these two sayings of John Mayne, I think, can lead us into this series of meetings that we'll share. Every time we sit to meditate, we enter into a great tradition. A great tradition. not a little tradition, it's a great tradition. And perhaps his most powerful insight, meditation creates community. So I hope we'll be discovering what those two insights mean in our own experience. I think when we go back to, we think of those primitive human beings in the caves of Lascaux and Chauvet. We saw this combination of being individuals and being companions in relationship. And we live the same paradox, each one of us. It's a joy and it's a suffering to have these both of these aspects of our identity. And the key word I'd like you to think about is belonging. Where do I belong? Do I belong in the job that I'm doing? Do I belong in the place I'm living? Do I belong in the relationships I'm in? Where do I belong? And the word belonging is an interesting word in English. I don't know if this, probably not sure it works in the same way in other languages, but you can look at that. But the English word belonging is composed of two words, be and longing. To be comes from a root word that means to become or to grow. To be is to be alive. To be is to be alive is to grow and change. And the other word is long, and that means to go, to move. So to belong is a dynamic idea, not just finding a safe place to hide, to protect ourselves. For some people today, the church or even a community or religious identity could be a way of just finding protection and security, but not a place to grow, not a place to be on a pilgrimage. And I think that's why we need meditation at the heart of the church and at the heart of all human community, really. Because it makes this connection between being solitary and being in relationship. And the word longing, which means to want something, to aspire to something, to feel a hunger for something, sometimes we can't put it into words what we long for. But we know we want something more, something deeper, something richer, something more human. And the wisdom traditions that we'll be looking at all agree that we have to let go of desire. Not because we don't have longing, we are creatures of longing, creatures of desire in a way, but we have to let go of our images, ideas, fantasies, especially of what we want, and we have to become the longing. We have to find that sometimes painful and difficult to describe feeling of longing for something, for wholeness, for love, for relationship, for creativity, for joy, for life. And the opposite of that is, well, what? We feel depressed, we feel hopeless, we feel frightened, we feel unwanted, unloved. That's not what we are meant to feel. We all feel it at times. But again, I think meditation is a wisdom at the root of human consciousness, which shows us a way to be our longing by letting go of the fantasies of desire. And then we begin to see how we fit in, where we belong, where we are at home. And we realize that in the great space of the universe, the expanding universe, there is a place. And each of us has our insertion point in the universe. So let's look at this word tradition. It's a funny word again because it comes from the Latin tradere, which means to trans, which means to go across, to build a bridge, to connect, but also to give. Tradere, to give across. What are we crossing over? We're crossing over the great emptiness between human beings, between generations, between the young and the old, or even the 20 years old and the 40 year olds today, between individuals, between husbands and wives or partners going through difficult periods in their relationship. It's part of human experience that we become aware of distance and separation, which can make us feel terribly alone, isolated. And we long for connection. And tradition is not something you put into a museum or that you just put on a library shelf. The tradition is a way of delivering, of connecting, of giving and sharing, exchanging across time and space. But it has another word, which translators, thank you to the translators who are working today. There's an expression, traditore, traditore, in Latin, because they sound the same. The word to betray and to translate. And this is one of the flaws, one of the faults in the human condition, that when we do communicate across the divide, across what separates us, we often feel we're not doing it very well. We're failing. I feel I'm failing now, you know. And we do the best we can and we try to correct our mistakes, but we often betray our longing and betray what we want to communicate. And so community, and community is an expression of a tradition. That's what the WCCM is. It's what the community at Bombeau is. It's what this group is, as I hope it will form over the next few months. That a community is an expression of this exchange and communication that takes place between individuals, even though it's not perfect. We make mistakes, we get it wrong. We are misunderstood, we misunderstand. But we keep going. So community is also a place of continuous correction and of forgiveness. Well, this attractive looking creature somewhere in the depths of the ocean, not something we'd want to meet on a dark night. I like this because it's one of the things that we have to be prepared for as we make this journey and as we learn to enter into a tradition. Sometimes there are frightening things that we find in ourselves, the shadow in ourselves, or in others. It's not all sweetness and light. It's not all easy. And there can be many unexpected challenges. But here, this also from one of those caves, is a beautiful expression. I don't know what this is, some kind of a rhinoceros. It's powerful. We encounter an energy of consciousness, and a physical and a spiritual energy. As soon as we begin to exchange, to share in community within a tradition, something more than we had expected. So there may be some challenges, some difficulties, some fears that we find in ourselves, but we also find a positive, creative, loving energy greater than we had imagined. This is one of the earliest pictures of yoga in a cave somewhere in India. And yoga, which is a great invention, a great discovery, a system of physical and mental training that allows us to become fully human, that prepares the body for meditation, and that allows the body to remain healthy so that we can meditate. This was the original purpose of yoga, was to allow us to meditate more easily and more healthily. Today, people meditate in order to be healthy, to let go of their stress and anxiety and insomnia. And of course, meditation does have these physical and psychological benefits. But today, we approach it rather the opposite way around. We meditate in order to be healthy. But in the past, originally, we looked after our health in order to be able to meditate. This is a quite old representation of pranayama, one of the arts of yoga, control of the breath. So we'll now begin to look into some of the just a very quick survey, really, of the sources of wisdom in different traditions. And this one is the Australian Aboriginal tradition. And this is actually a Christian woman, Aboriginal, Miriam Rose Ungenmeyer, who is very well known in Australia these days for her representation of Aboriginal wisdom. Our Mexican community last year hosted online a wonderful John Main seminar on Indigenous wisdom for modern people. And it was really raising our awareness of how much wisdom there is in our Indigenous tradition, native people traditions, that is of real value and solace to us in the developed world. And this is what Miriam Rose says. I was with her a few years ago. We did a session together, and She's a wonderful woman. She's very solid, very slow, and very silent. And when you ask her a question, she takes about 5 minutes before she answers. She's looking at you, and then you think hasn't understood, but she understands English perfectly, of course. But This is what she says to the Australians, the white Australians, as she calls them. We learned to speak your English language fluently for years. We've walked on a one-way street to learn the white people's way. I've learned to walk in two worlds and live in towns and cities, and I've worked in them. But now is the time for you to come closer to understand us and how we live. And this was one of the themes that came out of the seminar, that the modern world has a immense reservoir of wisdom and friendship waiting for us in the indigenous peoples who want to share it with us. Tajiri is the word that she uses in her language to describe contemplation. She says, we wait for the right time for our ceremonies and our meetings. They're not in a hurry. The right people must present themselves. Everything must be done in the right way. Careful preparations must be made. And we don't mind waiting because we want things to be done with care. Now, of course, white people looking at the Aboriginals preparing those ceremonies probably think, oh, these are very primitive, lazy people. They're not getting on with it. We're much more efficient and impatient. But there is a reason for their slowness, for their patience. Sometimes many hours will be spent on painting the body before an important ceremony. We don't like to hurry. There's nothing more important than what we are attending to. There's nothing more urgent that we have to hurry away for. And I think many meditators discover this patience. It's one of the fruits of the Holy Spirit, according to St. Paul. Love, joy, peace, patience. This ability to be content, to wait, to be in the present moment, to enjoy the present moment, to prepare. We wait on God too, she says. God's time is the right time. We wait for God to make his word clear to us. We don't worry. Again, white people would say, oh, these are lazy people, you know, they're not serious, they don't work hard. And of course, their culture has been broken by contact with the modern world. But here is an understanding of a contemplative way of living. We know that in time and in the spirit of Tajiri, that deep listening and quiet stillness, God's way will become clear. We cannot hurry the river. We have to move. So we're beginning to see, I hope, that in this tradition that we all enter into through meditation, we are finding some profound and practical wisdom about how to live. Now, I'm just going to jump around a little bit, but there is a connection between the different pictures I want to put before you. And this one is in Islam. We don't often think of Islam as a very contemplative religion, because it's been so badly misrepresented by the extremists. But Sufism is, of course, the mystical core of Islam. And Yunus Emery was a contemporary of Rumi, 13th, 14th century. He's one of the great poets of this tradition, and lived in Turkey. Zikr is this practice of the prayer of the heart, what we would call meditation, through the repetition, the incantation of a sacred phrase or a name of God. And they understood this, and Eunice Emery in particular, as a way of love. And the Christian contemplative tradition, in the same way, speaks about contemplation as a work of love. It's not about intellect. It's not about coming up with clever answers to difficult questions. It's about discovering our capacity for love by loving. How else can you learn to meditate except by meditating? And how can you learn to love except by loving? So the Sufi is a traveler on the path of love, a wayfarer journeying back to God through the mysteries of the heart. The Sufi, the relationship to God, is that of lover and beloved. And Sufis are known as lovers of God. And I'm going to, just as a little, partly because this is such a beautiful clip of the turning, the whirling dervishes, you've probably heard of them and maybe you've seen them. I thought this would be a nice moment to take a little break. But Rumi, of course, is associated with this Mevlava school of, and it's a different kind of meditation. Can you play it now? It's a different kind of meditation. Okay. Just about a minute. So maybe, Taina, can you put up on your magic screen a question? Just ask people what did you feel when you watched that turning? Do they know how to do this yet?
No.
Oh, they don't know. Okay. All right. Sorry. All right. We'll do it at the end. Sorry. I thought you had been instructed. And this is a way of you making comments, but we'll do it later. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Sorry.
I put the link of Jamboard here.
Okay. Good.
With the questions, Lawrence bring us some questions to reflect. We have to reflect about this. And I don't know if each one use Jamboard, but it's easy to use. You have just to click on this link. And we have five slides with each one have a question. So we would like to know and to share the feelings and the how these questions bring us some meaning or other things. So I put here on the chat.
Okay. If it,
yeah.
Oh yeah. So what do? They click on this. Oh yeah, somebody's. Oh, good. Messages coming in. Opening of the heart. Joy and peace. lightness. Okay. Well, I tell you what I feel when I see that. My eyes fill with tears. It's so beautiful. I don't know, it has an immediate effect upon me. The limited dancing with the infinite. Calmness. Absorption. These are very good. Syntonia. Serenity. Joe started at a college house, but I couldn't get over the nausea. Yeah, it's amazing that they don't feel dizzy, but the way that you can avoid feeling dizzy and falling over is how you use your feet. Otherness, a center, it's very centered and yet it's moving. Connection, libertad, freedom. Dizziness looks hard to do. Flow with the divine. It is beautiful, yes, that's what I found, just so beautiful and joyful, yeah. So, well, thank you, that's good. And I think, se me erize la pie, what does that mean? It makes me pie, what's pie?
Depth. Skin.
What? Skin. Connection and harmony, a higher state, opening to the divine in the physical dance. Se me erizo la pie. What does pie mean? Oh, goosebumps. Thank you. Gives me goosebumps. Yes, gives me goosebumps too. Crying. Yes, it made me cry. Piel is skin. Oh, okay. Goosebumps, yes. Yes. Well, we've all learned something today. What goosebumps is that Spanish or Portuguese? Good. Well, thank you. Let's go back. Spanish, thank you, Priscilla. Okay, so let's go back. So every one of these comments takes us into the experience. It is a description of what the tradition, the passing on, the giving to others of the way of meditation. This is a very common mantra in the Sufi tradition. La ilaha illa Allah. There is no God but Allah. There is nothing to worship except God. God, as it says in the Bible, God is all in all. So, I'm just giving you some examples now of meditation in the universal tradition. Dhyana is a Sanskrit word often translated as meditation. Advaita is the term that means non-duality or oneness. And one of my great inspirations in the universal tradition is Ramana Maharshi. And this was on the left. These are both pictures of Ramana, who died in 1950. And as a young boy, as you can see him here, he went through an experience of Advaita, of oneness. And many children do have these mystical moments of transformation of consciousness and experience of the divine. But what was unusual in Ramana, who was a perfectly normal, healthy Indian boy, was that he remained in this state of undivided consciousness for the rest of his life. It took him about 10 years before he began to speak again. But even as he became famous and as an ashram grew up around him, he would communicate mostly in silence. But when he spoke, his words were directly from the experience of non-duality. The self, the mantra, and God are one, he said. So here is, this is a picture of me with a Buddhist and a Muslim in an interfaith conference I was at a few years ago, and we were three monks, and we were chatting about, and started talking about rosary beads, and we all discovered we each had our own beads in our pockets, and saying, each of us, you know, would use these at times to say our mantra. So it's a universal wisdom. This is the mantra in Sanskrit, the mantra of the most famous mantra, of course, in India. The root mantra is thought to be Om. Primal sound expresses belief in the fundamental unity of reality, beginning and ending in God, often used to open other prayers or rituals. We have one of our Teze chants, or Teze light chants, that we sing here in Bon Vaux before meditation. One of them we used today, actually, I think it was Om Namah Christaya, a Christian version of a Sanskrit chant. And mantra japa is the repetition of the mantra. Often different traditions, they do it slightly differently. It can be done in a group, it can be done alone, of course. Mostly we recommend just doing it in the heart, but sometimes people use the beads. And the most effective recitation of the mantra is said to be silent and interior. This is I'm going to start moving on, I think, through this now, so I won't stay too long with this. But in the Upanishads, the great scriptures of the Indian tradition, there's this verse that says that in the house, in the city of Brahman, which is the body, there is a small house in the shape of a lotus, and in that house is a small space. And we must know what is there. That's what we long for. I said at the beginning, we are creatures of longing. And there, it is there in the heart that we find what it is we are longing for. If we look for it outside, we'll just feel the pain of desire. But when we find it within our heart, we find infinite space, heaven, earth, fire, air, sun, moon, lightning, stars, everything that is and everything that is not is there. That space is the home of God. Every longing is there. So, of course, this is a beautiful little statue of the Buddha that John Main loved very much. It was in the British Museum, and I was with him when we first saw it from Gandhara, from the northern part of India. And of course, Buddhism, the Buddha put meditation right at the center of his teaching. He called it right concentration. Going beyond external longings, sense desires, abiding then in the second level, the second jhana, which is inner tranquility, the unification of the mind, then moving in, even detaching ourselves from the joy that we feel in a peaceful and calm mind, and by giving up even not trying to cling to or possess the joy, we come to the goal of meditation, which is freedom from attachment. This is the Tibetan, the most famous Tibetan mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. And Dalai Lama speaks about this as meaning independence on the practice of a path, which is an indivisible union of method and wisdom. You can transform your body, impure body, speech, and mind into the pure, exalted body, speech, and mind of a Buddha. So this is a great claim, that the practice of meditation transforms us so completely. This was the Dalai Lama with Father John in 1980 when they met in our first in one of our first communities in Montreal. And I don't know who he is, but he somehow got into the picture. So we see the same in Judaism. This is the famous representation of the burning bush in the book of Exodus. The bush that Moses saw, which is burning but doesn't consume. And in the Bible also we find the essential elements of meditation at the heart of its teaching. Be still and know that I am God. God was not in the whirlwind, but in the gentle breeze. Be silent before the Lord and wait patiently. It's what the Aboriginals were saying, the Dejiri. In returning and rest you shall be saved, in silence and hope shall be your strength. And this is the great mantra of the Jewish tradition. Shema Israel, hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and with all your means. And you must keep this phrase, Shema O Israel, you must keep this phrase with you wherever whatever you're doing, sitting in your house, when you walk on the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. So we're coming up to our own time now. The question that many Christians ask, Western Christians anyway, is meditation prayer? And because most Christians were not introduced to meditation as a way of prayer, contemplative prayer, the prayer of the heart, when they do hear about it later in their life, they are often confused. As they say, did we see this in the Bible? You know, we didn't hear this at school. The priests never told us about this. But it's, I think, only in meditation when we discover this to be the central and foundation of all prayer. And I'll explain later what that means. It's only then that we can really understand these three dimensions of Christianity. On the right here, you have the transfiguration. That every one of us is called to be transformed, transfigured. And this occurred, of course, during Jesus' lifetime. Then he died. And most Christians focus only on the cross. Of course, the cross is pivotal, it's central. But it's the resurrection that we're preparing to celebrate in a few days. So to understand how these three things connect, the transfiguration of the human, passing through death, and rising to new life, I think we need to have connection with the prayer of the heart. And in another session, we'll talk about the wheel of prayer, and these different forms of prayer uniting in the center. And it's here in the center of the wheel, the heart, that we pray, that we meditate. We look at the teaching of Jesus on prayer, on the Sermon on the Mount. Again, we'll come back to this later. These are the essential elements of contemplation. Your inner room, silence, freedom from worry and anxiety, paying attention, and freedom from anxiety. And here you have, I rather like this, the secret is, at the heart of the Christian message, Christ in you, not just coming in the second coming, not coming next year or next century or whenever, but Christ in you now, your hope of glory. So usually we think of ourselves as these little cats. But when we are aware of what is in us and what Christ means and what the Christian message means, we see ourselves a little differently. So here we have the tradition of meditation in a few words. It's universal, it's unifying and healing, and it's simple, it's silent, and it leads us into stillness. This is a view from the back of the house here at Bombo. And this little path here has been made by the people living in the house who walk up every day, four times a day, walk up to the barn where we meditate. And that's what a tradition is. It's the path that is made by people who do it. And whenever we walk from the back of the house up to the barn for meditation, we all follow this path. Why should we go here? Why should we go over here? Why should we go? This is the quickest way. And it's easier to walk on also, because when it's wet, it doesn't get so muddy as, and you don't get your feet so wet as you do over here. So this is the value of a tradition. It's a path that has been made by other people before us, and we contribute to it by walking it ourselves. So we come out of this door here, and this is the path we walk along. This is the tradition.
You enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to the Contemplative Revolution podcast and listen to your favorite podcast app. In the media section of the WCCM website, wccm.org, you can also find a large amount of video and audio content on meditation. Thanks for listening. Bye bye.